The Power of a Second Chance from SDPB. Today is Monday, October 21st. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, Greg Sands, 2024 inductee into the South Dakota Hall of Fame. Greg Sands is the owner and founder of Sands Wall Systems, a regional leader in the drywall industry. His life took a winding path toward entrepreneurship, and his past has never stopped impacting his present. We'll discuss the role that a justice-involved person's community plays in their life. Plus, climate scientist and author Anna Farrow Henderson shares her path to science and how motherhood influenced her pivot to policy. Her book is called Core Samples. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. 10 new inductees have joined the South Dakota Hall of Fame in 2024. Let's get to know one of them today. Greg Sands began working in the drywall business in 1975. By 1994, he started Sands Wall Systems, which has become a regional leader in the industry. His business marked a new beginning in Sands' life. At 17 years old, he was arrested for drug distribution. He later spent time in federal prison. Sands benefited from a second chance, and now, as a business leader and a philanthropist, he works to offer a second chance to others struggling with addiction. He does all this while building Sioux Falls and transforming an industry.
Thank you so much. I was inducted by my friend Craig Lloyd and also Bill Hinks and Dick Muth, and it was a great honor. You know, they inducted me 3 years ago, and the hall has 3 years to put you in. Mm-hmm. So we were on year three. I'd kind of thought, well, it's just not going to happen, and that's okay. And then I got the call. I was with a good friend of mine in California named Kevin Kirby, who started Face It Together here. Mm-hmm. When I got the call, and that was appropriate, you know, and you know, it was really special to get it, and it changes my life in certain ways. You know, that's a very prestigious honor in our state. Very few men or women ever get it. And, you know, when I was in there standing next to the other inductees, you know, you're just surrounded by greatness. And then there's a lot of other former inductees that show up to that event because it's such an awesome event.
Yeah.
And it went great, and I had great help from my office helpers and my wife, of course, got the table and everything set up, and we just had an absolute blast.
It can be humbling, but it's also, you know, people will remember you for a long time to come, but they're going to remember you anyway. you know, school children might research you, but you also live among friends and employees who respect you. Let's talk a little bit about your business and the industry. When we look around, when I was a little kid, my dad was a plumber and a pipe fitter, and one of the coolest things in the world is to drive by a water tower and say, my dad made that.
Yeah.
He helped build that. Your fingerprints are all over the Midwest, all over the city of Sioux Falls. That's got to feel kind of cool.
It does. So the business was, I'm a drywall finisher by trade. I learned the trade when I was 17 years old in Rapid City. I had went to high school for 2 weeks. I tested out. I went to work for my friend's uncle in Rapid City at 17, and he taught me how to be a drywall finisher. His name is Benny Goldaid, great man. So I had a trade, and then I went traveling around the country in my addiction. And the good thing about the trade is, you know, you can get hired anywhere. A tradesman, unless there's no work, but a tradesman can move anywhere and get a job. And so I was able to do that, but the addiction just kept getting worse and worse, and then I had been in Los Angeles for about 4 or 5 years, and that's where I ended up on down on Skid Row at every morning, noon, and night, because that's where the drugs were. And I never lived in a cardboard box there, but I was very close. And it's such a dangerous environment. You know, mm-hmm. I almost got killed when I was there one night at 3 o'clock in the morning. And but made it out of L.A. back to Aberdeen. And that's where I was arrested. And I was guilty conspiracy to possess with the intent to distribute cocaine. I was my best customer, and you know, my best friends were the next best customers. We would pretty much use most of it ourselves. And I became incarcerated for 24 months. It saved my life. I needed to be out of the cycle of insanity I had been living in. I came to Sioux Falls in 1991. Federal government had given me $50 to start fresh. I had saved $1,000 in prison working for 25 cents an hour. And then my grandmother loaned me $2,500. I paid her back every penny. Before she died, I had paid her back $2,200, and I gave the other $300 to my mother. And but since that day, I've never asked anybody for anything. I've never borrowed money from anybody. And also, it's just kind of funny that, you know, when I was growing up, I was broke all the time, and so I wouldn't fill up my car with gas. Mm-hmm. I'd put in 10 bucks worth or 20 or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so at that point in my life, I had bought my first new pickup truck, and Pam and I, we kept that thing showroom clean every day. It looked like it came off the showroom. We were so proud. I paid $17,000 for it. It was a little blue Chevy short box truck. And the great thing was is I could use that truck to go up and visit my mother. She was sick and she was dying. And my mother got to see me get clean. That's one of the greatest things that ever happened out of all of this for me.
Yeah.
And then as I started the company in Sioux Falls, back to that, I had competition who were with malicious intent trying to take down my company.
Yeah.
Because of my past. And my company, you know, elevated past theirs pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And so there's some people that would say these negative things about me that were untrue. And I just took that as part of the deal. And I'm just going to be a better company tomorrow than I was yesterday. And all that noise will go away. And it took about 10 years. Hmm. But at year 7 or 8, the noise went away because I called the guy that was doing it. And this isn't like me, Lori. You know, I'm not to be very vindictive. I was very frustrated with this guy running his mouth to my employees about that the reason I was successful is because I had drug money, okay? I've never met a successful drug dealer in my life. I'm only 66. Maybe someday I will, but so far I haven't. It ends the same with everyone, jails, institutions, or death. That's the drug dealer's road.
That's the path, yeah.
Well, there's a fourth option. That's getting clean and sober, which is what I did. So when he was saying these things about the company, my employees would call me and say, this guy is saying you're successful because of this drug situation. So I got the call on Friday afternoon at 2 o'clock. I'm in Chamberlain. My guy had ran into this guy at a tire store, and the guy started saying how I was successful because I had this drug money. I didn't have 5 cents from drug money, never did. Anyways, so I called the guy up and I said, listen, I'm tired of you running these lies about me down at the drywall supply place. And Monday, my attorneys are going to get a hold of you. And today, I have enough money to put you down. And I will. And he called me Monday morning and he said, Greg, I am so sorry for what I have done. It is wrong. It's always been wrong. I've always known it, and I'll never do it again. And he never did. So there was some of that when I started, Lori. But then after year, when I hit year 10, 11, I started a steel stud framing division. By year 15, we were dominant in every industry in my scope of work. And then by year 20, I mean, we're largest in the state within 10 years. We're in the top 100 in America in 20 years. And when I did the ESOP, we were 33rd in America when we transitioned to the ESOP. And
which passes the ownership to your employees, for people who don't know. Yeah, the ESOP.
So it's an employee stock option program that takes all of my net worth and wealth, and my wife and I give that to our employees for free. They don't contribute financially to the ESOP fund. What they contribute is effort. You know, the better job they do and the more money that job makes because they're doing a better job is the more money that goes into their retirement kitty.
Mm-hmm.
And every man and woman will retire. And this is separate from our 401k. We kept that too.
Yeah.
And so every man and woman will retire with a much more significant amount of money than they would have without the ESOP. Because whatever the company's worth today, which is, in my opinion, a very big number, all of that transfers to them, 100% of it. You know, 10 years from the day that I did the ESOP, I don't own any of the company. I mean, today I'm the majority owner, of course, but I just keep giving my shares to the employees over the next 9 years.
I want to go back to this moment where you have this history of believing in yourself and standing up for yourself in a way that you can with integrity and also with courage and strength. That's not something you learn as a child.
Right.
That's not something you learn, like many of us learn our character attributes from our family or from our church or from, you know, some community of origin. Where does that come from? It seems to me very self-made for you. But is there any source for that you can tap into and say, yeah, this is where I learned that I have value?
That's a great question, Lori, because when I first got out, I was drywalling some houses up off of 69th and Western there, those beautiful Grand Prairie. I was drywalling these houses and met with the contractor. I'm working for another drywaller. And as we were leaving, we were driving by this contractor's house, and the drywaller I was working for said, this is where such and such lives, that's his house. There was a beautiful mansion, beautiful 6,000 or 7,000 square foot house with a BMW and an Audi and a Mercedes in the garage. And I had been out of prison for less than 30 days, but I had been clean about 14 or 16 months. So my brain was finally clicking on all eight cylinders, you know.
Yeah.
And I drove by this guy's house and said to myself, there isn't anything that guy is doing that I cannot do better. And so I had all of this confidence. And I recently spoke about this at some other venue I was talking at. Why all of a sudden did I have this confidence in myself that I could, you know, start a company and all these other things that I wanted to achieve, speak to kids and convicts about drugs? That's what I wanted. You know, that was a big thing for me. The accomplishments, when my brain was functioning at the highest level, you know, finally, because I wasn't, you know, using, I started having more successes. And so at that moment, I believe that what was different, Lori, to answer the question as good as I can, is that at that moment when I finally saw what I was capable of because the fog had been lifted, right?
Mm-hmm.
I had been incarcerated for 20 months. I was in a halfway house. I was working 14 hours a day, right? All I did was work and go to NA and AA meetings. And that was, you know, what saved my life was Narcotics Anonymous. There's no confusion about that for Pam or I. Mm-hmm. And we also started, I started the Help Start, the Narcotics Anonymous in Sioux Falls, mm-hmm. 30 years ago here. Me and 10 people went up to a park. We each committed to paying the rent on this building, and the meeting's been going ever since. And and it's helped thousands of people. Mm-hmm. But with that faith in myself, there's also the fear, you know, because I was building spec houses for a second. And, you know, when you're laying in bed at night and you have two house payments and you don't have any money and one house ain't selling, you know, it's just the angst and the stress of all that to function through that. Mm-hmm. And I believe another thing I had on my competitors that they didn't have, a couple of things. One was I was a tradesman, so I knew what the tradesmen wanted, you know, and they wanted to be treated with respect and dignity. And right now, today, if a contractor treats my people as a subordinate or less than, I'm going to go talk to that guy's boss and let him know if they treat my people like subordinates, that we won't be bidding to them anymore. Because I expect you to treat my people the way that we're going to treat your people with respect mm-hmm. and dignity. And if you don't do that, you're going to hear from me. And fortunately, I haven't had to make the call for 10 years, you know, because we just have great customers and they're professional. If they have to reprimand one of my guys, which happens because our guys make mistakes, mm-hmm. you do it the right way. You pull them off to the side, not in front of anybody else, and you reprimand them for what he did wrong, and you ask him what's the solution, and then we move on. And I'm surrounded by the A-team, Lori, and that's mm-hmm. another big part of my success is I am surrounded by the A-team in every sector of my life. Mm-hmm. The vendors that I buy from, the banks that I deal with, the people that work for me, the executives that work for me, the guys in the field, the women in the field, they care.
Yeah. After the break, more of our conversation with South Dakota Hall of Fame inductee Greg Sands. You're on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Let's return to our conversation with Greg Sands. He's a recent inductee into the South Dakota Hall of Fame for his contributions to the business sector and for his contributions to his community. When you think about justice, justice has meant different things to you throughout your life. From incarceration to a presidential pardon, to the injustice of being fired when you haven't done anything to deserve it. How do you think about justice today?
I think our justice system works. I'm proof that it works. I was incarcerated. I went to a halfway house. I did what the judge ordered, and here I am. You know, and that was I came through the system. You know, mm-hmm. and I helped Governor Dugard on many advisory councils and governor rounds over the years, and it was very rewarding. And we changed the justice system, you know, to mm-hmm. through the Criminal Justice yeah. Initiative. I was Dugard's keynote speaker for the CJI, mm-hmm. and that was one of the highlights of my life. Was you go out there and stay at the mansion and speak to the Supreme Court justices and. It was really cool. And then Judge Meyer Henry was on. She got inducted with mm-hmm. me last month or whenever it was. And we just had a blast together. And I believe that the justice system, you know, saved my life. And I believe that we're getting better in the justice system because we are putting programs in. I don't know where the DOC in South Dakota is at today, but in the BOP, the Bureau of Prisons for the Feds, they have the DAP program, Drug and Alcohol Program, and it's a great program. I've spoken at it down in Yankton, mm-hmm. And I think that my justice as far as if I am treated unfairly or unjust, I just don't go back there again. You know, I won't, for me to smack somebody down, it would have to be really a blatantly rude thing they did, and then mm-hmm. I will do that. And I have no problem with confrontation. But, you know, what I choose to do if someone is treating me or someone next to me unjustly in whatever environment it is I'm going to pay the bill, and then I'm going to walk out and not walk back in. Mm-hmm. Wherever, if that's in a bank or insurance company or a restaurant. And I feel the justice that was given to me worked. And my probation officers, I'm friends with both of them today. one of them came out mm-hmm. to see the Hall of Fame speech. The FBI director that arrested me, I talked to him right before the Hall of Fame. He's getting a little older and he couldn't make it, but he was invited to come. And, you know, it's a real blessing.
What kind of community are we building here for the future?
Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And what we offer to the residents, all the people that are here working in healthcare, mm-hmm. you know, what draws a doctor here or a nurse? Well, look at all this stuff we have for them to do, for the people to do. And that is done because both of our healthcare systems kick in cash over and over and over again to improve our community. And there's other healthcare communities in the United States that are very prominent. They don't have stuff. They don't have enough stuff for their doctors and their nurses to do outside of just the hospital system. And Sioux Falls has done a great job of giving, of making Sioux Falls so attractive to come here. And we're working on the Jacobson's ice rink right now. You know, he's such a special guy. Mm-hmm. He's done a great job, and the Lloyd family is doing Lloyd Landing down there. They're doing a great job. That whole river walk, I mean, that is cool. And I'm sure at some point there'll be some food trucks along there somewhere, and then we have the Levitt. And then we're always raising money, you know. Look at this Lifescape program that's coming out, you know, $100 million building, and Sioux Falls is just one of the greatest communities to live in. And I'm part of another group called the Alexis de Touque. It's tied into, and I pronounced that wrong, and the lady that's in charge of that's going to call me when I walk out of here and reprimand me. But it's donors that give large donations to the United Way. Mm. There's a group in Sioux Falls.
Okay.
That's, and then every year you commit to increasing your donation. And I think that we're the second most giving city in America, is Sioux Falls, South Dakota, to United Way per capita. And the first is some small city in Florida that everyone that lives there is a millionaire. You know, but Sioux Falls is number two, I think, is pretty good in good old South Dakota, don't you know?
Not too bad.
But I want to get back to Pam.
Yeah.
Because all the men and women that I see succeeding at a high level, and what's the definition of success? You know, so that's a whole different mm-hmm. thing. And what's the definition of recovery and sobriety? That's a whole wide open question. But back to Pam. You know, when all of this was happening, you know, everything was moving so fast because we're doubling in size every year, wow. you know, and at first, you know, mm-hmm. then you get so big you can't. I had 89% growth in 2014, so almost doubled in size, and that just put me to my knees because we were already a big company, and that was horrible. But Pam has been, you know, when she came to work for us, I was scared to death that we'd go broke next year, you know, because she was making $35,000 or $40,000 a year working as a hairstylist, And I thought, God, without that 40 grand, we're going to be living on the streets, you know. And, well, her coming into the office freed me up, so I didn't have to do all that stuff. And I went out and sold more jobs and hired more people and kept building the company like I was supposed to be. And she kept the front of the house in order, yeah. You know.
I want to say just what a privilege and honor it is for me to sit and to listen to you and be face-to-face with you, and how happy I am to be able to share this conversation with the South Dakota listeners. Congratulations on the South Dakota Hall of Fame induction. Well deserved.
Thank you so much.
Greg Sands is a 2024 inductee into the South Dakota Hall of Fame. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Minnesotan Anna Farrow Henderson is a climate scientist, an environmental policy advisor, and a writer. She's the author of Core Samples, a climate scientist's experiments in politics and motherhood. Her book is a collection of essays digging into her life as a field scientist, how she transferred to public policy working for Senator Al Franken and Governor Mark Dayton, and her journey into motherhood and how that changed how she saw science and her work. The book is funny, it's poignant, and I can't wait to share this conversation with the author with you.
So I think the seeds that were planted that grew into being a scientist were actually the same seeds that grew into being an artist. And so that observation, this close connection to the landscape, you know, it's like not just walking out to a landscape and being like, cool, but walking out to a landscape and like picking up a rock and seeing what's under it, or like putting the rock in my mouth, not as a little kid, but you know, even now, maybe because it changes the color. It's like looking at the plants and like ripping a leaf and smelling it, but just this deep interest. And I grew up in Providence, Rhode Island, but we spent 2 years traveling by land and then living, like I went to kindergarten in rural Asia, and the landscape was dramatic. And it was also very foreign, and I was carrying everything of mine on my back. And so this connection to landscape felt really palpable. We were in areas with earthquakes. There was an earthquake once when I was on the roof of the place we were staying in, and it felt like I was really connected to the land in a way that was important. And I was curious, and I asked questions. And like you say, like being a scientist is really, it's kind of as simple as that. It's seeing things and asking questions, and then what do you do with it? And when I got out of high school, I was not really that into school, or like I didn't have this image of myself as a scholar. I wasn't that excited about going to college. I got a job and I went to Italy to a place that had just had earthquakes. So again, I was in this dramatic landscape and I could see this huge effect on people. And I felt like to understand other people, I had to actually understand the landscapes that we live on. Like, I'm going to go to college. I want to study this, and I'm going to study geology.
Throughout your 20s, you're going to go on these expeditions where you face your own mortality a lot, whether it's on the ice and contemplating how dangerous it is to just be part of this ongoing collection of data, but that you might not make it out because of how tenuous everything is. Also, being in a lake and deciding to stay when lightning is approaching. There's a closeness to mortality. And I love this part that you say, you're trying to live up to the landscape and hoping that what you know in this moment, this truth, that I will remember it, that it won't fade like the patterns on a rock from the ocean when it dries, that when I am down from the mountain, I will still know what I knew up high. And that is so relatable for even anyone who's been on a vacation. And you're just like, I want to be, who will I be when I come home? Will I step back into these old patterns? Or will I remember this humanity now? What is it about field work that brings that out for you again and again? And does it bring it out for other scientists too?
I think that the field work in geology and in other areas of science where people go in the field a lot, it's really kind of the hook. So, you know, I was interested in geology. I knew that But then the reason I stayed, I think, was for these experiences of going out generally to remote places. You know, I used to go to lakes in Minnesota in the winter, and we're going out to the middle of them and spending hours. So it might not be remote, but it's like interacting with the landscape in this kind of intense way. I think I just felt more alive outside. There was an 8-week period where I did field work with my now husband as my field assistant, and we were going to lakes in the Rocky Mountains, and I didn't want to come inside. We were camping out, and even once we got north of Yellowstone, there weren't mosquitoes, and we didn't even set up a tent. We were just sleeping outside, working outside all day, and it just really, I felt really present.
You're going to leave it behind, though. As a mother, you want, and not leave it behind, but you're going to move into public policy. And part of the reason is because as a mom, you decide that you have to answer to your kids at some point. Like, you know that the planet is warming. You know that these decisions have to be made. And you say, I need to put on a suit and go see how the sausage is made. Tell us about stepping into politics and policy as a research scientist.
I knew nothing about politics when I got there. I had gotten a fellowship that placed me in Congress and that I could interview with representatives from in the House or Senate from any state, any political party, and work on any issues. But I was really excited to work on clean energy and climate issues because my science had really focused on understanding past periods of climate warming and what the impact was on water resources and on our forest and grassland ecosystems. And so when I got to politics, I was used to sort of running at full speed, and politics is really fast, but it's like I'm running in and then just lost. Like, I didn't even know really what counts as a suit for a woman. and I didn't really know how to wear heels. So I felt like a little bit behind. So I was, you know, I was 32. I was 6 months pregnant when I went to work for Senator Al Franken. And I was just figuring out some of these very basic things about being in this new setting. And within about a week, I was like, I was made to be here. And I had no idea that I would feel that way. I hadn't realized how technical policy is. Science is not the loudest voice that informs policy, which was a huge surprise to me.
Yeah.
Maybe it shouldn't have been, but it was a huge surprise to me. But it is part of everything. And so being able to come in, and not that I knew everything, I didn't know pretty much anything, but I knew how to learn about those details. And I felt really confident when people were lobbying me or coming in with bills that I could assess what this meant and know what kind of questions to ask. So it was really exciting to apply my science and to have it be useful. And to also, even though it sounds kind of stressful because I had a toddler at home, I was pregnant with my second child, and then I had the child and took some time off and came back, and I'm pumping milk during the day, but it was so fun that I wasn't just on an arbitrary timeline. Like, in research, things happen over years. It takes so long to do the work from when you have an idea to actualizing it and getting data and analyzing it. But in politics, it's like there's a vote in 5 minutes. What are we doing? What can you find out right now? Or like, oh, we just got a call. The senator has time on the floor tonight at 6 p.m. He's going to give a speech. Like, okay, let's finalize that speech. And that was really satisfying to have non-arbitrary deadlines. And the work that I was doing was going into things that were happening, and I could see them happening. Like, watching a senator read off a piece of paper what you've written, for them to ask a cabinet member or, you know, an expert, is really exciting.
And you come up with the congressional lactation diary, because they don't really know what to do with you. And it just seems like we should by now, right? Like, there should be a little bit better system by now. Were you surprised at how difficult it was to just figure out how to pump milk in the congressional offices?
When I first got there and I was asking around, and it's like nobody knows, and they're kind of embarrassed that you're bringing it up. I was the only mom in the DC office at the time. There was one other parent, I think, in the office at the time. So this wasn't like a topic that people were thinking about, though they were very excited to have me there. They were really welcoming. The first day, everybody was showing me their family leave policies, even though it didn't apply to me because I was out of fellowship. But and so I couldn't figure out how this was going to work. And I went to the nurse's office and they were so nice and were like, we have these rooms here that you can use. But then there were all these complications. Like I got invited to the White House a couple of weeks after coming back from maternity leave to go to an event for women working on clean energy. And I emailed ahead and said, I need access to a place where I can pump milk. And then when I got there, they weren't set up at all. And it took a really long time. And it was like this young man who had the key to the lactation room and was sort of, we got lost in the building and I'm following him around thinking like, what am I doing? Like, why is this
And he doesn't
the way it is?
understand. He doesn't understand that there's a sense of urgency here,
No.
because he has no lived experience about what it means to need to get to that room.
Yeah,
Yeah,
yeah. No urgency, no
we'll get
anything.
there.
At the same time, for anybody listening, like the US Senate has public rooms in the nurse's office that anyone can walk in and ask to use to pump milk. So you don't have to work there. You can be a constituent and want to go and talk to your representative, and there is a place for you to pump milk. So that was really beautiful. And then the other thing that happened is like at first it felt like I'm the only mom in this building. It's like marble floors. And I was like, oh my God, my water's going to break on these marble floors and everyone's going to slip. But as I was there longer, through word of mouth, I found out about these groups. There was like a bicameral group and there was a Senate group of moms, and that people that I knew from both parties were moms. And so there was this like, it wasn't advertised and it wasn't, there weren't signs up saying like, come to the lactating moms luncheon.
There's a lot as I read your rel and obviously people in South Dakota are well aware of Senator Al Franken's leaving political power during the Me Too movement, and I think most people are aware of Governor Mark Dayton's health problems when he collapsed at the State of the State address. You have a right-hand seat to some of those really dramatic moments in Minnesota state political history. But also, there's these just tender, everyday things where you're eating M&Ms or you're watching Mark Dayton eat M&Ms at least, and talking about how he wants to listen to people, how he just really enjoys, he enjoys a town hall. That's a great scene where he kind of says, I really enjoyed it. And you're like, I did not enjoy that. That was all about, like, carrying it off and protesters and who's going to speak and when, and you're walking on a wire. And he's like, that was fun. What did you learn about some of these leaders that you were supporting? I mean, I found it encouraging that they want to listen to constituents. They are men of the people in many ways.
So when I worked for Governor Mark Dayton, he at the time had a nickname that was the buffer bully. He had put out a new regulation on farmers that required 50-foot buffers between row crop agriculture and public waterways. And there was very little stakeholder process or usually like a law like that would have a lot of buildup and conversation and negotiation. And this was, he read a headline about how bad the water quality was in lakes in Minnesota. He was very concerned. He is not an environmental governor. That was not part of his platform. It wasn't a big part of other things he had done. And he just said, this has to happen. And everybody was mad, like from all sides. And nobody had been included in the law. You know, they're mad because it's just like coming at them. Everybody was like, lacked confidence really that we could do it. And it's amazing because Minnesota's done it and it's like a non-issue now. And if you drive through, you see these buffers and it's happening and they've lasted and it was implemented. But people were really angry at Dayton, and he's a little bit of a maverick. And I think that's one of the things that people love about him is that you know he's not doing things to be popular. He never tries to be cool. He's doing what he thinks is really important. And so he used his political power to push through this new regulation. But then people were angry and he wanted to hear them. He used to go to events with thousands of people and give out his cell phone number and say, I'm your governor. You want to call me? Call me. This is my phone number. And sometimes he would answer those calls, or, you know, somebody leaves a voicemail and then we would follow up with them and talk to them. So he really was serious about being accessible, that people had a right to access him. And so people were really, really angry about the buffer law. And his response to that was that we've got to go out and talk to everybody. We've got to hear everybody's voices. We've got to find out what they're doing. And we had done, the first thing I did working for him was a big water summit in Morris, Minnesota, which is central western part of Minnesota. And it was okay. It was a good event, but we kind of like, I'd only been there 3 months, and we sort of put everybody on stage who was like kind of on the inside. Like they were connected to major stakeholders. They were kind of nice. They were like safe people to put on a stage. And I had this conversation with Governor Dayton where I said, you know, if we're going to go out and do more of these events, I think we want people to relate to who's on stage more. And he was like, yeah. And I was like, well, to do that, we're going to need to put people on stage who come from a wider background. And by wider background, it's like their political leanings, their opinions about politics, their, you know, racial, ethnic background, their lived experience. And he was like, yeah, let's do it. Like, no hesitation. And so just that, you know, he wasn't afraid of people being angry or not liking him or saying bad things about him. He really wanted to be with people and hear them. And even we had a lot of protesters at these town halls that we did for all different reasons, from medical waste to oil pipelines. And he wasn't upset at all. Like we were doing an event and a bunch of students, yeah, like high school students, took over the stage. And he was like, Anna, give him the microphone. And so I give them the microphone and he just steps off the stage and he's totally like, he's like, this is fine, you know? And so we're sitting down on the floor and they're up on the stage and they can't figure out how to make the microphone work. And I was like, well, that's funny, you know, like, let them figure it out. And he's like, Anna, go help them turn the microphone on. So I go up and I turn the microphone on. And he just is like, yeah, like, everybody, please be respectful. They have something to say. And they said their thing. And then he was like, okay, like, should we continue the meeting? Or, you know, if you're not going to get off the stage, then we can end the meeting now. And like, there's that idea of not holding on to outcomes as a way to be happy. And it's really hard when you've spent a lot of time putting events together. And there were so many people, there were local teams that helped with all of these local events. And it felt like to not have an event finish would be tragic to me.
Yeah.
But to him, it was like, yeah, like we came and we'll see what happens. And we're not, nothing has to happen here. We're all here for the process.
Which is thematic in your life, the science collection outcomes, the policy, and then you move into writing and taking a break from all of it. And if there is not a better description of writing where you spend a whole lot of time and you really have no idea what the outcome is going to be, very little control over it, it's writing. How did you come to surrender to that, embrace it? I love this idea of having a cover story instead of a backup job or what do you call that? Like you know, backup plan, you call it a cover story. I'm a writer, but my cover story is I'm a journalist. So I love that. I'm going to use that. I will cite you every time, but I'm going to use that.
So I had been writing and I identified as a writer starting at like age 10 and it didn't get a great response in my home. So I kind of had that sense of like, this might make people uncomfortable. And then when I was in my PhD studying climate science, my PhD advisor once was like, well, Anna, like, what do you think you want to do for a career? And I said, well, you know, I really love this. And I think I want to be, you know, a research scientist, but like the world is big and I might be interested in other things. And I had like, I was 100% planning on being an academic. Like I had no other plan, but I was just trying to give a thoughtful answer. And he was sort of like had this very boyish face, really smiley. And it's like all the smiles went out of him. And he turned to me and was like, I'm investing in you by training you. And the expectation is that you're going to be an academic.
Wow.
Yeah. And I remember telling him once about somebody who was, people were doing internships with oil companies and you can make a lot of money in the summer. And he was like, oh, that sounds kind of dangerous. Like you got to stay focused. So I really had that sense of anything you're doing that isn't the science feels like a zero-sum game and you're taking away from it. So to not talk about it. And the first time I published something, and it was in a literary journal, I was 9 months pregnant. I was working for Senator Franken. I had only been in the office for a couple of months, and I was about to go into labor any day. Like, I was so huge. And this piece got accepted, and I'm looking through the Senate ethics to figure out, like, am I allowed to do this? I had submitted it before I worked there. And I just decided to publish under a pen name. So I actually had kind of this, like, talk about a cover story. So it was like publishing under a pen name for about a decade until I made the decision that, like, if I really wanted to write the things I wanted to write, I needed more time, and I was going to need to take that time.
If all of our scientists and all of our policymakers feel the hesitation to tell story that is baked into how they do their jobs, think of the stories that we're missing.
Yeah, and I think about, like, people talk about science often as something outside them, like something that other people do or experts, or it's not relatable. Like, it's something from the outside, instead of seeing it as something that belongs to them or that they're a participant in. And I think it's because it can be hard to relate to, because we just really show the outcomes and the deliverable. We strip out, you know, everything messy, and you just have these kind of sterile, isolated facts. And it can be hard to relate to.
What's next for you? It's such a beautiful book, and I think it will have, my prediction is that it will be important, and then it will have a really long life. It will be like Braiding Sweetgrass, where it comes back again and again, and people will continue to discover it and have a beautiful, nice, slow build to being something amazing. That's my prediction for this book.
Thank you, Lori. I'll take that as, like, a blessing. Some, like, wind behind wing.
It has that, it just has that essential nature to it. And the writing, of course, is so well done and beautiful and thoughtful. But what's next for you as a writer?
Well, I'm going on a book tour, and I'm doing traditional book tour things, like going to bookstores and some universities and colleges. But I also wrote a grant to do a rural book tour with the goal of bringing art access to rural communities. And so for that, I designed interactive art projects. One of them is a community bookmaking project with book plates. And everybody will be invited to write a 7-word memoir on the book plate and put it into this book. And a book plate denotes ownership. So then every page of the book is like, this book belongs to you. And it's another person. So, like, we're all creating this book together. So I'm really excited to go out and talk to people. I'm going back to some of these places where I went with the governor, and part of the, you know, controversial buffer bill. And I'm really excited to go back in a really, really different position for a different kind of conversation. Yeah. So that's my near-term thing. I'm really excited to see what people do in these art projects.
That's policy advisor and author Anna Farrow Henderson. Her book is Core Samples, A Climate Scientist's Experiments in Politics and Motherhood. And that's our show for today. We hope that it served you. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.